You're listening to Pep Talk, discussing policy, evidence and practice in Wales. Pep Talk is brought to you by the Wales Centre for Public Policy at Cardiff University. This episode of Pep Talk was recorded in December 2020, prior to the end of the Brexit transition period on the 1st of January 2021.
Hello and welcome to Pep Talk. Following the 2016 referendum vote to leave the European Union, the UK government has proposed a new immigration system that will come into effect once the transition period ends. The main effect of the new system will be to create equal status for EU and non-EU migrants and to end the free movement of labour to and from the European Union. These reforms of the immigration system will have significant implications for employers, workers and communities in Wales. Provisions have been made to exempt certain NHS roles and a small number of social care occupations. For other migrants wishing to live and work in the UK, a skilled worker visa with a salary threshold of £25,600 will apply. However, because average wages in Wales are significantly lower than the UK average, the salary threshold could lead to recruitment problems for employers in Wales in sectors that rely on migrant workers. In Wales, this includes large numbers of employers in sectors such as manufacturing, higher education, tourism and hospitality, culture and the arts, and health and social care. At the Wales Centre for Public Policy, we've been helping policymakers assess the impact of the Brexit migration reforms on Wales's economy and society by providing evidence on various issues, from the impact on employment and the economy through to community relations and integration. My name is Dr. Craig Johnson, and with me today to help unpack this topic are three experts who will each give their view on the likely impacts of post-Brexit migration policies and offer insight into the ways in which the Welsh Government could seek to respond to the challenges and maximise the opportunities that the new migration rules will present. So my first guest is Lleya ap Gareth, who is a Senior Policy Advisor at the Federation of Small Businesses Wales. Could you tell us a little bit about your work and how this relates to migration?
The Federation of Small Businesses, for those who don't know, is the authoritative voice for small businesses. And in Wales, we have around 10,000 members. Small businesses are businesses from zero to 249 employees, basically. And in Wales, they are almost overwhelmingly what we call micro businesses, which is from one to nine employees. So in terms of how migration would affect our sector, businesses in the small business sector tend to struggle more with complexity and with the difficulties around not having their own HR departments, in having, for example, the employers who are the owners who also have to know a little bit about everything, including everything from skills through to all the HR stuff that you have to do. So therefore, any big changes to these sorts of areas will have a big impact on our members, as well as clearly on the economic impact that's wider. So for my work is to do with policy in the Federation of Small Businesses. So I look at that side of things. We also provide support and advice, and we also engage with the business sector.
Also joining us today is Dr. Sarah Kiambi, who is Director of Migration Policy Scotland. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about Migration Policy Scotland and the current work that you're doing?
So I'm an expert on immigration policy and have worked for various think tanks in London, Brussels and Edinburgh over the last 20 years on migration. I've now set up a new independent single issue think tank on migration in Scotland, which is Migration Policy Scotland. And our aim is to promote and sustain a constructive approach to immigration. Our current work is focusing mainly on the impacts of the end of free movement. And we're keen to pursue work that increases the understanding of migration issues that are a bit more pertinent in Scotland, but sometimes don't really feature at UK level immigration policy discussions. By that, I mean work around the link between migration and demographic challenges, but also the role migration may be able to play in relation to sustaining rural and remote areas.
And finally, we welcome Professor Jonathan Portes, a Professor of Economics and Public Policy at King's College London, and a Senior Fellow with UK in a Changing Europe, an independent research body funded by the ESRC. Jonathan is one of the co-authors of our report on the UK migration policy changes and the implications for the Welsh NHS and social care workforce. Jonathan, could you just tell us a little bit about the focus of the work?
So, well, I've done a number of reports working with colleagues at the Welsh Centre for Public Policy, looking at the impact of migration on the Welsh economy. The most recent of which, as Craig said, focused in particularly on the impact of the new system on the health and social care workforce, which is a particularly interesting sector since, as everyone knows, it is dependent both on migration from within the EU and outside the EU. And the new system will make a huge difference to who the NHS and social care employers can recruit and how they recruit them. There'll be some positives and some negatives, as our report shows, and I'll come on to those, no doubt, in due course.
Excellent. Thank you all for joining me today. So I just want to start by getting a little bit of context about the post-Brexit immigration reform. So, Jonathan, I'll come to you first. As we've already mentioned, the new post-Brexit migration system is going to repeal freedom of movement. It creates a new points-based framework. Can you just tell us sort of the key features of the post-Brexit migration system that have been put forward by the UK government?
Well, the key feature, as you said already, Craig, is this equalisation. That is to say that instead of the current situation where basically anyone from the European Union or elsewhere in the EEA automatically has a right to come here and work with essentially no formalities at all, and people from outside the EU have to go through a relatively restrictive system, pay a lot of money and cross a lot of hurdles, this system will be the same from both. And what has happened is neither, certainly not a levelling up in the sense of giving the same freedoms to people from outside the EU, but it's not quite a levelling down either, in the sense that the new system is somewhat more liberal for people and somewhat easier for people coming from outside the EU than the current system. So the new system is based on the current system that applies to people coming from outside the EU, but it's slightly easier in some respects. In particular, the most important single criterion, which is the salary for which the job you're coming to do applies, that is significantly lower for the new system at about 25,000 rather than 30,000, which makes a big difference. Although it's still above the average salary in Wales, there are a lot of people and a lot of jobs in that band between 25 and 30,000. And second, the skill threshold for occupations is somewhat lower. Mostly it's people with A-level qualifications and above doing jobs that paying 25,000 and above that qualify. An additional liberalisation, however, is also that people who are doing their first job or doing a training job, the threshold is in practice a bit lower still. So once again, a bit of liberalisation. And then a final area in which things have been liberalised is students. So students who finish their degree in the UK at a university will be allowed to stay on for 2 years to do essentially any job under the new system. And that's, again, a big liberalisation and returns the system something much closer to what it was before Theresa May put on much heavier restrictions on students in 2012. And then finally, one very important point is the introduction of the new healthcare visa, which essentially means that most medical type roles in the NHS will automatically be deemed to qualify. And what that means is that basically, if the NHS decides they want to offer a job to somebody in one of those roles, then the salary that the NHS pays is automatically enough for that person to qualify for a visa. And the visas will also be somewhat cheaper and hopefully faster and more efficient. So while for employers who hire European workers a lot, particularly for low and middle school roles, and obviously many of the small businesses don't have any contact with the immigration system at all, but do hire Europeans, this is going to be a potentially big new increase in bureaucracy, a big barrier to hiring workers from abroad, particularly from Europe, that wasn't there at the moment. On the other hand, in some respects, particularly perhaps for some universities hiring academic staff or hospitals hiring medical staff, things may actually be somewhat easier than they are currently.
Thank you. So I'm going to move to Sarah just to talk about what lessons and learnings the Welsh Government and Wales might take from Scotland. So Sarah, as we heard from you at the start, the Scottish Government has put forward proposals on migration earlier in 2020, and those are cited in our reports on post-Brexit migration in Wales. Can you just tell us a little bit more about the proposals that have been put forward by the Scottish Government?
The Scottish Government, I guess, have been very active in trying to get some of its aims met from an immigration system where the new proposals have been mainly designed to reduce net migration rather than to meet any broader policy aims. And I think from the Scottish Government perspective, there is concern to meet some of those broader policy aims. One of those would be about the role migration should play or could play in meeting demographic challenges, which are more pronounced in Scotland than they are in England. That's something that Scotland shares with Wales. You know, as Jonathan said, moving the very flexible migration that we've seen through free movement into the UK immigration rules, where it'll be subject to salary thresholds, even though those salary thresholds and restrictions are slightly lower, this is going to be a significant change. And I think there has been concern about the impact of that in terms of employer access to migrant workers. And so the Scottish Government has very much lobbied for a spectrum of options, or at least to have the conversation about what are we trying to do from immigration policy and what options are there for Scotland to explore a degree of variation from the UK immigration system, be that a variation, you know, very much in terms of the roles and mechanics of how the system currently works, all the way across into actually a variation in terms of having more powers over immigration, such as the power to issue visas and to have a Scottish specific visa. Now, out of that, the one success that there has been is that there is a Scotland specific shortage list. There was one previously, but also, and I think here is something that the Welsh Government could take notice of, there are now devolved nation shortage occupation lists. Those essentially reduce the salary threshold that's required to recruit workers into particular occupations. And I think the signs are that, unlike previously, certainly the Migration Advisory Committee has made far more recommendations for what occupations should be on that list. But I think particularly given that the lack of nuanced data for the devolved nations and in Wales, I think there's a real role there for the Welsh Government to support employers and employer representative bodies to engage with the MAC, to engage with how the MAC kind of does its analysis to draw up, you know, the shortage occupation list, because that level of stakeholder data will really help, that there's a role there to help inform what that is, and that might be a way through into having wider access to migrants across a broader range of occupations. But again, I mean, as Jonathan has said, that there has been significant change in terms of the student visa, but also the health and care visa. So I think as the situation unfolds, and as we get to see more what the labour market will look like, not only post-Brexit, but potentially in a post-COVID recovery, I think there is going to be a lot of change and there might be new sector-specific schemes opening up. I wonder whether, particularly given the wealth of evidence on shortages in the care sector, will lead to there being a social care-specific route opening up, or whether there will be an expansion of youth mobility schemes going forward. And I think that the government really, there's a role to really engage with that, providing the evidence, the analysis to back up the arguments, to open up the migrant labour supply where that's needed, but also to feed in so that we know when that's needed, because at the moment it's being closed and it's incredibly difficult to predict where that might go.
A couple of things I want to sort of pick up on there, and I'll open this to all three of you. We'll come back specifically to sort of health and social care later on in the podcast, but the distinction between the extent to which we should look at immigration and the rules and the reforms relating to sectors and occupations, and the extent to which we should look at it as different nations of the UK or different regions within England and see it as a geographical sort of question to think through. So I guess I'm just interested to what extent, when we've lowered the salary threshold from 30,000 was the original discussion now to 25,600, does that make a huge difference to parts of Scotland? Does it make a big difference to employers and workers in Wales? When we look at 30,000 and 25,600, is that not particularly relevant to most of England except for London and the South East? What's the geographic nature of the question when we're looking at that? And then your point there, Sarah, about the shortage occupation lists, to what extent should we be focusing on these? To what extent can they make a big difference, whether we're talking about social care, but just generally as well? To what extent are these shortage lists a sort of way out for certain sectors?
The key thing to remember on geography and wages, I think, is that it's London that's an outlier rather than Wales or Scotland. There isn't actually a huge wage differential between Wales, Scotland, the North East, the South West. The differential is really between London and its wider economic zone, which of course goes well outside London to large parts of the South East and the rest of the country. I think to some extent, you could look at the original threshold of 30,000 as having been set by reference in many respects to London, and the new threshold being at least a gesture to the rest of the country, in the sense that I think if you'd asked the Migration Advisory Committee to set thresholds but geographically, they'd have probably come up with 30,000 for London and 25,000 for the rest of the country. So I think in that sense, it's not a bad result, particularly given the lower thresholds that apply for younger people in training type positions. It does, however, still leave some sectors, social care, hospitality, and so on, with a big set of issues to confront. And that's that, you know, and that actually is also true to some extent in London, because there are plenty of low-paid people in London as well. But it's particularly true, obviously, in Wales.
I think there's an interesting question there around the difference between the geography and the economic disparity and the wage disparity. Taking away the idea of London, which Jonathan's already discussed, I think the report is quite interesting in looking at the wage discrepancy within Wales, areas like Gwynedd, the more rural areas, where in fact lots of our members and a lot of small businesses are away from perhaps the more urban Cardiff, Newport, Wrexham, those areas, that these areas that do have issues with the level of wages in those areas. So that I think there is a difference to be made between when looking at wages and regions or nations here. What is the aim of something like the shortest occupational list? And how does migration correspond with other policy outcomes and who's in charge of them? Which is where I think the shortest occupational list becomes quite interesting when looking at perhaps economic developments in Wales, you know, where what areas can Welsh government identify as being of particular interest to Wales? And where does the shortest occupational list fit into that in order to help us with the economic outcomes that we're looking for? Within that, then, I guess there's a discussion about where those skills go within Wales. But I think that's the interesting part in some respects of how does the SOL actually shape the wider migration discussion? And are we looking at migration in terms of skills and a wider discussion around wider policy? Or are we merely looking at it in terms of the numbers coming in and that sort of idea, which is a wholly different thing. And in terms of small businesses, obviously some of the issues that we have is that 95% of small businesses from our surveys have not had any link to any kind of migration system at all. You know, even those who have EU nationals working for them in SMEs, and that's about a quarter or so, they've tended to recruit from the UK itself. So there are long-term implications for that as well, which is something that probably won't come out in the first few months or anything after Brexit, but are the long-term implications of where these skills come from. And again, why the need of discussion around migration and skills need to fit together with the wider policy developments, if you like.
Yes, absolutely right, that the key cleavage is between London and the rest of the UK. Or perhaps that if you're looking at wages, there's also a kind of an urban-rural split, which is difficult in the context of having a single salary threshold. I think where the devolved nations angle becomes interesting, but I think also difficult to think through, is that I think the devolved administrations provides you with a level of government where one can, in principle, see the capacity to engage with what can be quite macro level issues and the need to really process a lot of data. So I think the reason it's ended up being devolved administrations that have been trying to put together a case for why they need migration in their regions is partly because migration obviously is a cross-cutting issue and it impacts on devolved policy areas. So there are things that devolved administrations are seeking to do with migration that the very restrictive policy coming out of Westminster makes more difficult. And there is the capacity to engage with that. just following up on the previous point, that this is quite, it's a very challenging area to engage with. You've just mentioned that, so for instance, with the system going forwards, small businesses in particular will struggle with the amount of bureaucracy involved in both applying for and maintaining an employer sponsorship license. I think that's something we're currently working on, just in terms of flagging up the kind of bottleneck and hurdle that is going to represent for a huge amount of business who have not really engaged with the UK immigration system proper at all, and will have to do so for the first time when free movement comes to an end. And I think we'll find that to be quite a shock, unless significant parts of that system are reformed in the next 6 months, which they may well be, because it is there are a lot of responsibilities and duties to be discharged by an employer in holding a license. And I think for very small businesses, I would be concerned, as you have been voicing, about the ability to discharge that and the potential to incur fines and other types of penalties. I do think, I mean, the Home Office have been consulting with businesses and other stakeholder groups in the different devolved regions, and they have not really been meeting with any of the devolved administrations since the middle of last year. And I guess, I mean, this reflects sort of some difficulties about the constitutional settlement, but I think one of the difficulties, without wanting to comment on that, one of the difficulties I see there is I think it's very difficult for smaller level stakeholders to comment on things like how to tackle demographic challenges, how to devise policies to ensure the sustainability of rural and remote locations, let alone what the role of migration within some of that will be, because that's only part of the answer to any of those puzzles. But those are very large, very complicated puzzles. And I'm just, you know, I do see a role for larger level government institutions in trying to tackle those, rather than leaving them for business stakeholder representatives or other types of third sector groups to feed back to the Home Office on.
I think there's definitely that sort of long-term goal, isn't there, to see immigration as one part of that kind of holistic policy approach to these long-term issues, whether it's demographics or skills or other aspects. I want to come back to small businesses and the kind of, whether it's bureaucracy or direct impacts of migration changes that we want to sort of talk about. We know from our own research that certain sectors are going to be particularly affected by post-Brexit migration reforms. We know that small businesses are just going to be affected quite badly as well, just because of their capacity and their resources. We've got one report that's going to be published in January 2021 on the implications of Brexit for key trade sectors. And one of the things that struck me in that report is that from January 1st, 2021, whatever the new arrangements in place, businesses, and especially small businesses, are going to be breaking the law without realising. There are going to be changes that they're unaware of that they just haven't been able to respond to for whatever reason. And it's going to be just an ongoing issue. And I think, as some of you have alluded to, some of the changes, they've already been felt between 2016 and now, and they're going to be felt for years to come. It's not merely a sort of January 1st kind of problem. So I'm going to start with you, Clea. Can you just tell us a little bit about the impact on small businesses in Wales? You said a little bit, but just how are small businesses preparing for the changes? How should they be preparing? What don't they know? What do they know?
Those are all very big questions, which we've been struggling with probably for the best part of the last few years. But I think what we're seeing is that Brexit, and I'm going to have to discuss COVID on this one as well, is what they've shown are things that we already know about small businesses in many ways, but they've amplified and all these issues exacerbate all of those issues about how do we deal with those. So you discuss, for example, what do businesses know about this whole agenda and where it's going? Well, I suspect it's not as much as we would like them to know. When issues are complex, when there's so much stuff at stake, I think Sarah was very good at discussing licenses now, which is, the idea of what your duties are if you're looking for the license to take on foreign workers, as will be the case next year. It would be doubtful, even without COVID, that small businesses as a sector would generally know that much about all of that, because in many ways, I don't think that most of those businesses have thought of the EU nationals that they have now working for them as within the migration policy per se, because in many ways they haven't been. So I think that the practical experiences they've had don't really fit into knowing about what's coming, if you see what I mean. Now, the trouble that you add onto that is COVID, which is over this year, small businesses in particular have been, within the economy at least, one of the worst hit parts with COVID. And that, again, just takes away from businesses who are struggling with capacity anyway, but now have to use as much of that capacity as possible. At least for some of them, it's to ensure their survival. For some, it's to try and adapt, try to find new ways of working, all the things that COVID has brought out. Now, in some respects, that has shown that many SMEs are actually able to adapt quite quickly when needed in terms of a crisis. So in some respects, you could say that bodes well for the future on issues such as this. On the other hand, there's only so much adaptation you can do all at once, I think. And when your house is on fire, trying to work out what the garden looks like or whatever, it isn't so easy, right? So I think the issues here are, yes, there's the complexity of the system, but the particular timing of the introduction to the complexity of that system is particularly unfortunate, we can say. And I think that we have engaged quite a lot with Mac, with the Home Office as FSB, and they've been very open to engagements. There are questions we have about, there have been allusions and promises to having a very simple streamlined system, that this will all be available digitally and so on. We haven't seen anything of the digital system that will be coming to place, at least at the time I'm talking now. And it's very difficult, therefore, to say that the systems are in place to be able to make things easier for small businesses as well, because we haven't seen them and we're putting a lot on trust on that side of things. I guess, finally, I guess the last thing to say is, in terms of for many, and this is more of a wider Brexit point than migration per se, but for a lot of our members, and anecdotally, when I've spoken to people as well, is that they've seen a lot of deadlines come and go, often with apocalyptic sort of overtones, and with the idea that, you know, everything's coming to an end at this date, then this date, then this date. And that was originally, I think it was end of March, you know, 2 years ago. And what some of our members said is that they found that the ones who did actually prepare were put at a competitive disadvantage, because the others who didn't bother used that time to do other things that were useful for them. So they didn't have the opportunity costs. Now, you can get away with that so far, but I think a lot of our members who might not be so engaged with the process as we are will have seen a series of phony wars happening and are now kind of thinking that actually January now is going to be just another example of this again, which it, of course we know it isn't, but for many people it's still a transition period just being extended or expecting it to be extended, even though we know that that's not been the case since July. So it's all of that problem of knowledge gaps as well, which just reflects, small businesses reflect much of the wider population in that respect, in that, you know, they get these, their news in the same way as everybody else. They don't follow it avidly. And that's completely understandable, of course, but it is also something that needs to be addressed, and we need to make sure that on migration, and given that quite often the recruitment processes will take a bit of time on the whole, that we need to make sure that we keep at it and bring small businesses into that discussion over the first months of next year, as well as over the coming weeks.
I think that's a really good point that we've heard in our work about the sort of the previous apocalyptic warnings, and there's a sort of, there is a boy cried wolf kind of danger to this, that this time is going to be different. It's harder to believe every time that happens and it's repeated, isn't it? I'm going to look to move us on, but first of all, I guess just on the small business point, so Jonathan and Sarah, anything you'd want to add? Particularly about small businesses and their employees?
Well, I think the point that small businesses face bigger costs in dealing with the immigration system, you know, the healthcare sector is used to dealing with immigration processes and procedures. Yes, there is going to be a lot of change, but they do have, you know, people are employed specifically to do this. I know that in my university and in I'm sure in areas where Sarah has worked, you know, we have people whose job it is to do visa stuff if necessary. It's not cheap or easy. It's complicated and sometimes goes wrong, but we sort of have an idea of how to handle it. That is not the case for many small businesses. And so I think, you know, the challenges they face are going to be real. And as I think the point that for the last couple of years, businesses in general, but small business in particular, have had an awful lot thrown at them, one thing after another. And hence, it's quite difficult to actually get the bandwidth to prepare. I think there is clearly, however, a silver lining to COVID from a migration point of view, which is that had we been in normal times, you know, I think there would have been a serious concern that the Home Office simply wouldn't have been able to introduce an all singing, all dancing new system for everybody on January the 1st. And you would inevitably had teething problems, which would have led to employers not being able to recruit the people they need, people being stuck in limbo, all sorts of delays, not to do with the structure of the new system, but simply to do with the processing and computer system type issues. That now seems quite unlikely for the obvious reason that because of COVID, relatively few employers are going to be hiring relatively few people, whether from outside the EU or inside, in the immediate future. Possibly the only sector that will is the healthcare sector. And as we've said, they're relatively used to it and they have this whole new visa just for them. So they're better placed. So I think the chances of this ending, you know, being a real mess in January and February are actually considerably lower than they would have been absent COVID, which is one sort of small silver lining to this whole affair.
But I guess the challenge, though, is working out what the emergent mess is going to be. I agree with you, it's going to be further down the line, but in a way that's become so incredibly difficult to predict. So for instance, whereas before the salary threshold would have alerted us to probably shortages in hospitality, tourism, those types of sectors in Scotland, it's very difficult to predict now, well, what is going to happen in those sectors in Scotland? Or once the recovery gets underway, potentially trying to distinguish between what are COVID-related impacts and what are impacts of restrictions in the labour supply. So what is that down to? And is the system impeding the recovery, the new system impeding the recovery, or is the recovery just really difficult and potentially not going to happen for certain sectors? At the same time, we also will need to think about, well, people who lose their jobs in certain areas, if we have higher unemployment, you know, in theory, there's more labour supply in the UK. The problem is trying to work out how elastic that is in terms of where it can go in the country. And that, again, is something quite very difficult to work out. There's a whole spectrum of kind of legitimate reasons why people may not move between sectors, between occupations, between locations where they live. And I mean, the experience over the summer with seasonal agricultural work certainly hasn't been encouraging in that there needed to be people flown in the end to help in that sector. I would very much doubt that even expanding the source pilot to 10,000 will meet the need for seasonal agricultural work in the UK. But also relocating for seasonal work is obviously an even bigger hurdle than relocating for work. So maybe that's not necessarily indicative. But I think there's an awful lot, with there being so much change, it gets incredibly difficult to try to model and understand what aspects of that change are necessary. And I think this is being done deliberately, in part to meet the desire to restrict net migration, but also in part to encourage productivity and an idea that from the government's perspective, from the UK government's perspective, that there has been a reliance, an over-reliance on cheap labour, and that is what is hampering investment in training and skills and so on. And I think as we get on with exploring, well, how will that work? And do these changes actually lead to the posited benefits? It's problematic to have quite so much, just so much change that one can't really relate causes to effects in any clearer way. And I think so in the end, this has become mandated by the politics, and maybe that's where Scotland is rather an outlier in contrast to Wales, because in Scotland, you know, we didn't vote to leave the European Union, and the most recent election has seen gains by the SNP largely at the expense of the Scottish Conservatives. I think that makes some of those arguments that at least in Scotland, we were not looking to buy into this new system is stronger, I think, than in Wales, forgive me if I get the political interpretation wrong. I am not I'm not looking to speak authoritatively on that. But I think, you know, if you look at similarities and contrasts, there are strong similarities in the labor markets, lower wages, rural problems, demographic challenges. But the political signaling and the mandates for some of these actions are quite different, which actually makes quite interesting to think through how the administrations could work together on these issues.
I think it's a really interesting point, and certainly to try and, whether it's in a few months' time or in a few years, to try and think about how do we think about the success of the new system? First of all, what does good look like, and how are we measuring that when we've got so many other factors going in, never mind just the daily and weekly and monthly churn of an economy and the changes across the labour market? You know, interesting kind of questions and problems for everybody in the next few months and years. I'm going to move us on to the health and social care system, which has sort of been mentioned and sort of running throughout this podcast. So we published a report in the autumn of 2020, which was authored by myself, Jonathan, and another colleague, Dr. Elsa Uman. And that looked at the impact, or the likely impacts, of the migration reforms on the Welsh NHS and social care workforce. I'll hand over to you, Jonathan. Can you just tell us a little bit about the likely impacts and then some policy options or potential options for the NHS, for the social care sector, and for the Welsh Government?
So, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that on the whole, compared to where we could have been, this is relatively good news. The combination of the reduction in the threshold and the introduction of the new healthcare visa means that the problems for the NHS, I'll come on to social care in a minute, are likely to be significantly less than would have been anticipated just a couple of years ago when we first saw proposals for the new system. So what are we talking about here? First of all, in terms of overall numbers, about 8% of Welsh NHS staff are non-British. Of that, about 5% are from the EU, 3% from outside the EU, which is quite a lot less than the total in the UK as a whole, where it's 14%. So Wales is less exposed. Within that, Wales is particularly dependent on non-EU nationals for medical and dental staff, where non-EU nationals are fully a fifth of the total. But as I said, in some sense, that can be seen as good news, because the rules for non-EU nationals, especially in the medical and dental group, are going to be significantly more liberal after January 1st than they are now, because of the introduction of the healthcare visa and the other liberalizations with respect to non-EU nationals. Overall, while there are likely to be some issues, those issues are going to be concentrated in particular grades where there are EU nationals who are paid below the threshold and wouldn't qualify for the new healthcare visa. That's issues like some medical assistants, ambulance drivers, and so on. But mostly, we think that the NHS should be able to manage this transition relatively easily. It will need to make sure that everybody who's currently working and who's an EU national does apply for settled status. We don't want to be in a position where people who've been here a while find that they're suddenly losing their theoretical right to reside. But again, that is a question of, that's not a system issue so much as just making sure people are aware of the situation and do what they need to do. Social care is considerably different. Particularly in recent years, a significant proportion of new recruits have been EU nationals. EU nationals are reckoned to make up perhaps one in five, or one in six to one in five of nurses in social care in Wales. And there are generally recruitment difficulties anyway. And this is compounded by the general pressures on social care and restrictions on, and the fact that funding is just too small, which introduces pressures on the service overall, but also means that it's just very difficult for the system to increase wages to the levels necessary that you would need to in order to allow the recruitment of non-EU nationals. So I think there is a significant challenge there. So far, the government has stood fast against the idea of having any special scheme for the social care sector, either in Wales or indeed anywhere else in the country. I think this is going to be a tough challenge. And Again, there's a set of priorities around ensuring that staff who are already here feel able to stay and that they are supported to do so and through and apply through the process. But there's also a longer term challenge of simply increasing the amount of funding that's available and ensure that it is directed at improving the terms and conditions of staff. And that will help both in terms of being able to recruit, train, and retain people who are already here, and then possibly, depending exactly on how the system evolves, to allow migrant workers to come in from abroad in the future. And I think it's important to emphasize that in health and social care in general, it's never been about Brits versus foreigners or migrants. The system has always had a significant dependence on migrant workers for good reasons. That's not something to be ashamed of. And it's perfectly possible to improve terms, pay, conditions, and training for Brits at the same time as allowing migrant workers to come here and treating them well as well.
Thanks, Jonathan. Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that sort of interested me there. So I know that when the idea of shortage occupation lists and sort of special kind of mention for social care has been highlighted, a response of the Migration Advisory Committee and others has been to say that the problems of the social care workforce in terms of recruitment and retention of staff is not a migration problem. It's a sector problem that needs to be resolved long term through funding, through changes in structures and so on. I guess to all of you, to what extent is that fair? Should we see it solely as that long-term problem? Are these both things that we need to think through at the same time? Sarah, you said about sort of seeing migration as part of a broader kind of holistic long-term policy approach. What is the purpose of migration compared to other public policy kind of outcomes? To what extent should we be seeing this as a migration problem? Or to what extent is it fair to just see it as we've got to change the paying conditions of the sector?
Migration doesn't provide a full answer to the challenge of how you counter an ageing population. You can reverse population decline, as Scotland has, by bringing in more people, but migrants age the same as anybody else. You can help offset population ageing. You can give yourselves windows for other solutions to take root, where if you're looking at things like rural sustainability. It's more a part of having different levers to hand. And it's really not an either or question the way it does get framed. And I suspect that that's the same with labour market issues, is it's not migrants or productivity. Often those two things go hand in hand. And one of the key things migration does is help economies run well by filling skills gaps, by bringing in, you know, new innovation, bringing new people. But a lot of what is happening in terms of the policy development has been about politics. And that's not often about what might be good either socially or economically for this country.
Thank you. And then I guess a question back to Jonathan and to Clear as well. So one of the potential opportunities that could be for the social care sector, but also other sectors that might be negatively impacted by the migration reforms, whether that's hospitality or tourism or other sectors, is that coronavirus has changed the domestic labour market, and there might be more domestic labour supply, not just available, but potentially keen to work in sectors that they might not have worked in previously. It's probably too early to tell to what extent that's the case, but to what extent do you think that theory is a sound one, or is that far too optimistic as to what we might see as rescuing sort of shortages?
I mean, I think it's too early to tell what the impact of COVID will be on the labour market. But I think, you know, challenges around improving training and conditions as a way of getting people who are already in the resident labour market to get good jobs, enjoy their careers and move up is a medium to long term challenge for all sorts of sectors in the UK. We have had issues around in this area for literally decades, certainly all the time I've been involved in public policy, and they're not going to go away or be solved soon. And certainly COVID isn't going to solve them. If COVID and Brexit together give some impetus towards focusing minds on solving them, that will be a good thing. But there's nothing new here.
Yeah, I'd say similarly, it's too far too soon to tell, and it probably will be too soon to tell for some time, I'm guessing. But I think that's one theory. There's a few sort of theories going around, and I mean, there's also, yeah, there might be more opportunities for people to move into jobs from the indigenous market, if you like, but there's also some dangers for, I mentioned earlier, that there might be a window or breathing space for recruitment and that sorts of thing for SMEs. Well, that is also dependent on how welcome people feel here, which was addressed in your report, and that there are indications that there are, in fact, already people leaving the UK, or that the ONS recently came up with a whole load of statistics around indicating that. So that idea of retention of skilled labour is one side of it. I think focusing minds on the skills challenges is probably a good way of looking at it. The theory being that if we are to create an impetus that we need to train people in the UK, then that will happen. I'm not sure if that works quite that simply, but hopefully it will give an impetus to all the governments in the UK to move towards looking at skills in that way. And looking for it from our members' perspective, looking at the skills in terms of in-work skills, making apprenticeships more available, all of those things. We've found it very difficult for our members, is again, because they have to look at across the whole piece of things, that they also have to look at where the skill system lies. Making things easier for them would be useful. So remembering that build it and they will come is not the best way to approach it, but rather you need to go to where our members and our businesses are as well. So I think that's a possible outcome of this, and is supposedly part of the aims of it. So that could be an opportunity. I think the question around what jobs we now value has changed, and I think that's true across everywhere, and all shop workers and so on, you know, even the question of whether salary is actually the best way to decide what we value is actually now a question due to coronavirus. And again, to come back to Sarah's point earlier, I think there was the really good point about there being so many variables in the mix now as well. That coronavirus is changing so many things that we probably took for granted before then, as well as Brexit happening, which changes a lot of things that were shifting the whole ground beneath our feet, that it's actually quite difficult to work out what's coming. But on the other hand, I guess that means that there's a lot of room for ideas, new ideas to come in. That would be the optimistic side of it. It's too early to tell.
Thank you very much. I'm going to end us there. So we've enjoyed a really informative discussion today on a very topical issue. And it seems that there are a number of ways in which employers, policymakers, and the Welsh Government might want to consider attempting to address the issues that have been identified in our work. You can find more information on immigration and Wales and Brexit in the description box, as well as all of our work on this issue. I'd like to thank Jonathan, Sarah, and Talia for joining me today, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Pep Talk. Don't forget to click the subscribe button and rate us on your favourite podcasting app. And I hope you'll join us again soon for another Pep Talk.